Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who?
His name is Rao.
His name is Rao.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Hey there, everyone. Welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and I'm deeply surprised to find us here at episode 15 already. The episodes seem to be going by so fast. Anyway, how was your week? Mine was, well, I've got to say, interesting. We're living in a Doctor Who free world at the moment. We've just had 12 weeks of Doctor Who. It all ended last weekend, so I've gone through this week and now this weekend without Doctor Who. There is, of course, a light at the end of the tunnel. There's a Christmas special coming. But after that, there'll be a big break until probably the middle of next year before we see any new Doctor Who. So it's a kind of a weird sort of come-down feeling. It's not quite depression. I wouldn't get depressed over any TV series myself, but it certainly is different to not be waking up on a Sunday morning here in Australia and watching a TV show simulcast in line with the British transmission and then jumping onto the podcast and talking about the episode. It's a brave new world. So, continuing along that line, Kate, myself, and Lex sat down this weekend to record our thoughts on the second half of this new series of Doctor Who, Series 8, and the full episode of that will be out next Wednesday. Older fans of the show might know that we did this for the first half of Series 8 as well. I think that went out in early October, if memory serves correctly. And we always have a lot of fun doing these shows, and there's even a teaser of it later in this episode. I plucked out the section where we spoke about Death in Heaven, the final episode of the series, and I've put that into this episode to fulfill the fact that normally Lex would review the previous week's episode, so here she is reviewing it, but it has the added bonus of myself and Kate talking in it as well. And if you like what you hear there, do tune in next Wednesday night and you can hear us talk about the final six episodes of the series in a similar way with a wrap-up. And it's that wrap-up I'm thinking about as I speak here, because it's in that wrap-up that I make the comment, and I wanted to talk about it in a more expanded way here, that this series of Doctor Who I've enjoyed in many ways. There are pieces of writing, there are scenes, there are snatches of story, there are ways characters develop that I think are great. I think are on par with anything else Doctor Who's ever done. And in fact, there are some bits of dialogue I think are well in advance of many things Doctor Who has done. I think of the first episode, I think of Deep Breath, and the way the Doctor is sort of telepathically linked to the dinosaur wandering up and down the Thames, and the dinosaur is in distress, and it's wondering, where are the trees, where am I, what is going on? And it's heartbreaking, and it's beautiful writing, and, you know, the fact that the dinosaur then gets set on fire and killed soon after just makes it even more heartbreaking. You know, just great stuff that really resonated with me and has stuck with me throughout the whole series. So there have been moments in Doctor Who this series like that, and yet when I look at the series overall, and particularly when I look at the last two episodes, the big finale, they just didn't grab me in the way that finales normally do. Even in the past, even when we had little finales, say, The Stolen Earth and Journey's End back in the Tennant era, a lot of people found that quite cheesy, you know, where all the old companions were standing around the console and the music swelled and they're all looking and smiling at each other. And, you know, I enjoyed all that sort of stuff, you know, call me a fanboy. I was like, oh, this is great, you know, but this past finale, I just really couldn't get into. There were bits I didn't like. Overall, I just wasn't that enamored with it. The whole thing felt unresolved. And one of the comments I make in the wrap-up to our episode next Wednesday is that this is a series of Doctor Who I don't want to go back to anytime soon. I'll likely buy the DVDs. I might wait till they drop a little in price because I have no need to watch them at the moment. And in the future, I can imagine myself watching them, but in the immediate future, I can't imagine that at all. I can't imagine going out and buying those DVDs the day they come out and wanting to rewatch any of the episodes. And that might sound quite harsh, but it's genuinely how I feel. I still consider myself a Doctor Who fan. I think Peter Capaldi is a wonderful Doctor. I have a lot of hope for the future of the show. But this series, I've watched it, and it's sitting with me, and I just have no desire whatsoever to go back and look at any of the episodes at this point in time. And in fact, when I think back to some episodes, like Robot of Sherwood, for example, honestly, I think at this moment, will there ever be a time I want to go back and watch that? And of course there will be at some stage, even if it's 3 or 4 years from now, I might say, hey, Robot of Sherwood, I might watch that. And I'll likely pop it on and I'll laugh at the funny scenes and I'll think, oh, that wasn't so bad after all. But what I'm saying is in the here and now, sitting here today on Sunday in Australia, whatever the date is today, the 16th of November, I just have no desire to go back and watch any of this series. And that is a new feeling for me. Honestly, that is a very new feeling. At the end of any series of Doctor Who, I might not want to go back and revisit all of it straight away, but there would be at least a few episodes where if someone said, hey, do you want to watch blah, blah, blah episode? I'd say, sure, that sounds like a great idea. Or if one of the episodes would pop up here on ABC television in Australia, I would continue to watch it. I'd say, oh, look, it's blah, blah, blah episode. Let's watch it, you know, to my wife. I don't talk to myself like that. And it's just a curious feeling that I don't feel that way about this Capaldi series, even though I really enjoyed Capaldi as the Doctor, even though I really enjoyed chunks of this series. So I don't know about you people out there. Maybe you can write in and let me know, email, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you like, and tell me how you feel now that this series of Doctor Who has ended. I'm not throwing this open to the Moffat haters who are going to say how much they hate Moffat. And I'm not throwing it open to the people who, like, on Gallifrey base score everything 10 out of 10, and just because it's got Doctor Who on it, they think it's brilliant. I'm throwing it out to the rest of you, the people who are in the middle, not at either of those extremes. Those of you in the middle, how do you feel? Do you think you could, you know, go and watch some episodes now? Do you have no desire to do it like me? How are you feeling? I'm really curious to know. Anyway, moving on, I've been reviewing a couple of podcasts in each episode so far, and I'm going to continue that here, but with a twist. I'm running out of regular Doctor Who and Star Wars podcasts that I listen to. There are obviously many more out there, but in terms of ones that I actually listen to and would thoroughly recommend from myself, they're sort of thinning out on the ground. So what I wanted to do this week was talk about one that relates to Star Wars and one that relates to Doctor Who, and I think you'll see how they do in a moment. The first is I Love Green Guide Letters. Now, what's the link to Doctor Who? Well, the host of I Love Green Guide Letters is also the host of This Isn't the Podcast You're Looking For, which is a Star Wars podcast, which I've mentioned on the show before. His name is Steele Saunders, and he's a Melbourne comedian. His I Love Green Guide Letters podcast has been going a lot longer than his Star Wars podcast. And the premise basically is there is a section in Melbourne newspapers, I can't remember which one it is in particular, called The Green Guide. And it's for the TV and movie listings and things like that. And it's printed on green paper so you can easily see it and pull it out of the newspaper each week. And that has a letters section. Now, this letters section famously has people writing in who just, you know, bitch and moan about the stupidest stuff. So what Steele does every week is sit down with a couple of comedian mates, and it's different comedians in each episode, so you never have the same team sort of popping up all the time. And he pulls out the green guide, and he reads the letters in a funny, high-pitched voice, which makes what are ridiculous letters seem even more ridiculous when he does it in this particular voice. And then he and the other comedians will talk about the issue that gets raised, and sometimes they'll talk about it very directly, sometimes they'll go off on tangents. And, you know, I'm maybe not selling it as well as I could here, but it makes for a very interesting show. If you like podcasts where you can just pop them on and it's a conversation and it's funny and it's something different every week, this could really be the thing for you, because even if you're overseas, you'll know many of the shows that are getting spoken about because many of the shows are international in scope. But even if something is a local Australian product, you'll still understand it enough to really get into the conversations, and it's just a lot of fun. So that's I Love Green Guide Letters. Details about it are in the show notes. And the second, relating to Doctor Who, I thought, how can I tie this into Doctor Who? And then it just hit me between the eyes. Doctor Who, traditionally, and even today, is all about exploring history in different ways. When the Doctor goes back in time these days, we don't call them historicals like we used to back in the 60s, but there's still enough information about Earth's past in some episodes of Doctor Who for it to really appeal to the history buffs out there. And that's why I've pulled out Hardcore History as my second podcast for this show. Now, Hardcore History is hosted by Dan Carlin. He's a US journalist, or maybe ex-US journalist. I'm not sure if he does it anymore. And he deeply researches specific historical topics. He doesn't consider himself an historian, but he considers himself quite an enthusiast when it comes to history. And he will read up on dozens and dozens and dozens of books about a particular topic and then present it as a podcast. And these podcasts typically run 2, 3, 4 hours each, and sometimes they run over a series of podcasts. For example, I'm currently listening to his World War One series at the moment. I think he's put out about 4 episodes so far, and each of those episodes went over 4 hours each. So I've listened to 16 hours of him talking about World War One at present, and I'm desperately awaiting the next 4-hour installment to come out whenever that is. It might be another month or two away. And that's something to really note about Hardcore History too. This isn't a podcast where you would listen to it every week. I mean, there's a lot of episodes out there available for free, and you could listen to it week after week for a little while, but then you'd run out of episodes. Basically, this is a podcast where you dive in, you listen to the series you like. Maybe it's the World War One series, maybe it's the series where he talks about Genghis Khan or whatever, and then you have to wait several months for the next episode to come out. So if you're into that kind of thing, if having a podcast sit there in your podcast app and it might not get that little light up button next to it for months on end, then this is highly worthwhile. It's one guy just talking, but in a very enigmatic and interesting way. I find them great for long drives, and I find them great for looking at historical issues that, even though I might know a lot about them, for example, World War One has always been a personal passion of mine. It's something I did in high school at a 3-unit level, which is a higher level of units than is normal, when I did modern history there in high school, and something I've followed ever since through various things, notwithstanding the fact I collect military medals from World War One. I still learn an awful lot when I listen to his podcast. So if you're a Doctor Who fan, or even a Star Wars fan, of course, who is into history, I can highly, highly recommend Hardcore History with Dan Carlin. And again, I'll throw notes into the show links, so check it out. All right, and that's probably where we'll leave the intro for this week. There wasn't a lot else happening for me this week. Well, there were a few other things, but they're probably going to get touched on in my top stories of the week. Yeah, it's an interesting post-Doctor Who world at the moment, and I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on that. Plus, as always, if you have an iTunes account, I would love you to open that iTunes account right now, go to the Who Wars entry, and give us a rating and review. The review can be just one line. You know, it doesn't have to be anything extensive. If you want to write something extensive, of course, I'll read it out on the show. But reviews and ratings on iTunes really, really help us get seen and noticed by other fans just like you out there on iTunes. I notice a lot of shows, even shows I listen to, which I imagine have much higher ratings than this show, I notice that even they don't get a lot of iTunes ratings and reviews, and that's a great shame. I think if all of us could lift our game a little and go out and review a few shows on iTunes, it would make the podcasting world a better place. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox there and say, without any further ado, here are my top stories of the week. Okay, and on to my top stories of the week. I've got 4 interesting tales to tell this week. The first of which is Christopher Nolan, big-time director. He's got a new movie out at the moment called Interstellar. It's quite polarizing with a lot of people, actually. Some people call it genius, some people call it total wank. It's a 3-hour space epic, and I would go into it with an open mind. If I was you, that's all I'll say about that. Christopher Nolan's obviously doing the rounds, talking about Interstellar, and in the midst of this, he has spoken a little about Star Wars, and he's commented that he would never take on directing a Star Wars movie because he would be too afraid. There's an actual quote. He says, "I'm pretty excited to see what JJ is going to do with that," meaning Star Wars. "I'm excited to see that he's shooting on film and actually building the Millennium Falcon." So Christopher Nolan repeating what we as fans have been saying for months. He goes on to say, "As far as whether or not I would have ever done it, the truth is I think I'd be afraid to touch it. He's boldly going where he went before in Star Trek." Nice pun there. "And it takes colossal balls." He continued saying that he was more comfortable doing his own thing rather than carrying the weight and expectation of the entire world. He added that he was among the obsessive fans of the trilogy, which he describes as, and I quote, 40-somethings who live and die with each new bit of information about Star Wars. And that certainly describes me and many people I know. Nolan was 7 when he first saw Star Wars, this report says, and he has never forgotten the incredible nature of that experience, the possibility of the screen opening up, sucking you in and taking you to a different galaxy. So very cool to see that Christopher Nolan's a fan. Disappointing that he thinks he'd be a bit scared to take it on, but I do know what he means. It is incredibly ballsy to stand up to the millions of Star Wars fans around the world and say, hey, I'm going to make something new that, you know, will become part of, you know, this canon, this thing that you've believed in for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It does take, yeah, a lot of balls to do that. So I get where he's coming from. Moving on, as many people know, the Dark Horse people will no longer be doing Star Wars comics in the new year. The license has gone to Marvel. I could say gone back to Marvel, because it was originally Marvel who started publishing Star Wars comics back around the time of A New Hope. Indeed, it was the Star Wars license that actually saved Marvel's skin. A lot of newer comic fans might not even realize that Marvel was in such trouble back in the 70s, and it was really the Star Wars comics that helped bring Marvel back into the black and make Marvel a viable company and what the company is today, with all these great movies on the screen and obviously so many comics that they pump out every month. It's an interesting backstory, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. Obviously, Star Wars is going to Marvel in the new year. They'll be doing a range of books. They'll be doing a book called Star Wars. They'll be doing a book called Darth Vader. They'll be doing a book called Princess Leia. And they're doing one based on Kanan Jarrus, the character from Star Wars Rebels. I think in his younger years, before he becomes a rebel, before the time of the Star Wars Rebels TV series, basically when he's back as a Padawan, as I understand it, and the Jedi Order is still together and all of that good stuff. Anyway, Marvel has given us a sneak peek at the Vader comic, and I'll pop up a link in the show notes. They've given us a few pages from it, and I don't know what to make of it. The scene is Jabba the Hutt's palace. It's very Return of the Jedi, and instead of Luke Skywalker infiltrating the palace, well, infiltrating's the wrong word, he did go through the front door after all, he just used a little mind trick on Bib Fortuna, and in he walked. But yeah, these pages are sort of aping Luke Skywalker's entrance, but using Darth Vader instead. Now, I'm pretty sure this must be some kind of dream sequence or something like that, because I think it's fairly well established in lore that Vader never sets foot on Tatooine again. Well, I probably shouldn't say that, because lore is up for grabs in these days where the extended universe is no more and so on, but I think fans have always kind of thought that given that Vader came from Tatooine and didn't have such great memories of being there, obviously his mother died there and he couldn't save her and all of this stuff, it's kind of built up in fandom that that's why Vader doesn't go down onto the planet's surface in A New Hope. He stays up on the ship. It's a planet that he probably doesn't want to set foot on. So I think seeing Vader go into Jabba's palace is odd, because he wouldn't set foot on Tatooine. I also think it's odd that I don't think Vader would go into Jabba's palace for any reason anyway. I mean, Jabba is a small-time gangster on Tatooine, which is a backwater planet, you know, full of moisture farmers and criminals. So would it be a place he goes? No. But would it be a place he could maybe dream about? Could he foreshadow Luke going there with himself in Luke's place? It's probably along those lines. Anyway, the artwork is fantastic. It does bode well for the look of the series. As to the storyline, there's not much we can glean from these pages. Again, I think it's a dream sequence that we're looking at. Moving on, later in this episode, you'll be hearing a teaser of Lex, Kate, and myself talking about Doctor Who Series 8 in retrospect. This is the second half of Series 8 we're talking. We did the first half, early October, I think it was. And in that conversation, spread throughout that conversation, but particularly when we're talking about the final episode, and you do get a taste of that later in this episode of Who Wars, we were talking about Clara and her ending on the show. And I think we came to the conclusion amongst the three of us, well, it certainly was my opinion at least, that things felt unresolved. The Doctor and Clara lied to each other. They said goodbye. That was it. I thought, well, I think we've got to see Clara again. We've got to see some sort of cameo in the new series. Maybe we'll see her at Christmas. Obviously, people were talking about how Jenna Louise Coleman was doing the convention circuit, which is something that current contracted actors in Doctor Who don't do, which was their way of thinking that maybe she wasn't in the Christmas special. And indeed, the first sort of look we got at the Christmas special didn't have her in any of the scenes. However, we now have a longer video where we do see that Jenna is in the Christmas special. We have her talking to Santa, and then the Doctor turns up, and, well, why don't I just play you the audio?
Stop. Seriously, you're Father Christmas, you're real.
Of course I'm real.
How can you not be real?
Huh? How do you think those presents got under the tree every year? By magic?
Well, I thought it was my mum and dad.
Oh! Well, of course it was.
I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, your mum and dad, one day a year, for no particular reason, just out of the blue, suddenly decide to give you a great big pile of presents.
No, because they love you so much. It's a lovely story, dear.
Yeah, but it's time to start living in the real world, yeah?
Okay. Right, Clara Oswald, mostly famous travel book science kits. Strict ban on hair products. Marginal for loyalty list, 93. Believer until the age of 9. Why did you stop?
Because you're a fairy tale. I grew out of fairy tales.
Did you, Clara?
Did you really?
Clara, I want you to step inside the TARDIS. I don't want you to talk. I want you to do as I ask, please.
That was good with the box.
Not often we get upstaged on a rooftop.
Yes. I'm really here. I'm back. Now get inside the TARDIS.
I know what this is. I know what's happening. And I know what's at stake.
I don't think you do, Doctor. But I promise before this Christmas day is done, you will be glad of my help.
Happy Easter.
Cool exit, I know.
Be sure to save some room for a tangerine, Doctor.
Nobody likes the tangerines.
So, very interesting there. Jenna meets Santa. Or is he Santa? He kind of does the jolly ho-ho-ho stuff and then breaks into more sort of modern street language. I'm wondering whether there's some sort of twist there. And then, obviously, with the Doctor turning up and taking her away, what's all that about? It's Christmas time. Is there going to be some sort of happy ending? Will she be reunited with Danny? Will things finally get worked out between the Doctor and Clara? Does it suggest that she's going to be in the new series in a bigger way than we thought? As I've always said, she's the ongoing companion in the new Titan Comics 12th Doctor line, which I found interesting. Obviously, we've already had an issue of that out, and I was quite interested in the fact that they were using her as the companion rather than a generic companion, and I thought, is this meant to be a TV tie-in? Or will we get to next year and we have a new companion on the screen, but we still have Jenna in the comic books? I couldn't quite resolve that. It's very murky what's happening with Jenna at the moment. It's been murky about her appearance in the Christmas special, yet she's obviously in it. And it's still sort of murky as to whether she'll come back in the new series. You know, if there's this whole storyline of her being pregnant and obviously having a child that belongs to Danny and that child growing up, and eventually we get to Orson Pink, you know, generations down the timeline, maybe she's going to come back. Maybe it's in a cameo. Maybe she'll just be in a few episodes. I don't know. It's very, very interesting. What do you think about that? Drop me a line, as always. And moving into our final story of this week, Stephen Moffat has been in the Radio Times essentially defending Doctor Who. This is a bit of a strange thing. Normally Doctor Who is big and strong enough to stand on its own two feet, but I guess with some of the episodes this series underperforming, and interestingly I think it was Flatline, one of the more interesting episodes, that underperformed the most. I think that came up during our Series 8 discussion that you'll hear next Wednesday. It's kind of curious to see Moffat take this position. He's put some interesting quotes into the Radio Times. I'll read them here. He says, quote, "A show dies when it's reliable like an old pair of slippers. If any reviewer says that about a show, that show is gone within a year. Shows die when people say, oh, it's quite good. I quite like it. And the new show is old now, so this had to be a reinvention," unquote. And by new show, he's obviously referring to Doctor Who as it came back in 2005, and by the time of Series 8 coming along, it's obviously an old show, so he did have to do something different. However, Moffat still acknowledged that some might have found it harder than others to warm to this new Doctor in the form of Peter Capaldi, and he said that it's all part of the plan. And before I read this quote, I think, yes, I would have to agree with that. Before this series even started, he was clearly saying they were taking a new direction. And obviously the casting of Peter Capaldi himself heralded a new direction as well. So that's not a very new thing to say, but this quote is new, so let's get into that. Quote, "This has been different and designed to make you go, I don't trust him yet, I don't know what he's like, what's he going to do next? It's exciting and it makes the show new again. If people say, I'm appalled by the new Doctor, I say, yeah, yeah, and you're watching it every week," unquote. Moffat also defended the series' apparent falling ratings this series, which saw Capaldi's debut episode watched by fewer people than the first appearances of previous Doctors, Eccleston, Tennant and Smith. Quote, "Indisputably, without doubt, exactly the same number of people watch Doctor Who now as they ever did. There is no drop-off in the ratings, but the way people watch it has changed," unquote. And by that, he's obviously referring to the overnight figures versus the consolidated figures. These days, compared to 2005, many more people in the audience will watch Doctor Who at a different time. They won't watch it live, so to speak, off the TV. They'll watch it through the BBC iPlayer or in some other way, perhaps a repeat screening. And that's actually borne out by what Moffat continued to say. Quote, "They watch it on catch-up at a far higher degree. In the time I've been doing Doctor Who, the number of people who watch it on iPlayer has trebled. And even if our overnight ratings were our final rating, it would still count as a hit." And you know what? That's quite true. I mean, Doctor Who, I think the average overnights have been around 5 million as an average. I think the first episode was higher than that. But if we say around 5 million, that is still a really good ratings figure, even if you don't count the actual consolidated stuff that comes in over the week after. And I think a lot of people forget that. I'm already seeing some articles, particularly on US websites, so perhaps they don't quite get the ratings in the UK or the figures involved. Perhaps by having such a larger population, the ratings seem a lot lower than what they should be to an American. But I think what an American writer might have to think about is the actual size of the UK population versus the US. Because I see people writing these articles saying, is it the end of Doctor Who? Like, we've had a series with bad ratings. And it's like, well, the overnights might have been a bit lower, but as we've been saying here, and as Stephen Moffat's been saying, the consolidateds have been pretty good. And the figures overall are good anyway. So, no, the show is not going to be cancelled. Doctor Who is one of the biggest money spinners for the BBC worldwide that you can imagine. Even when you think of some of the bigger shows that the BBC might have in the UK, they don't have quite the worldwide effect that Doctor Who has. Doctor Who is massive, and I think these people who write these strange articles about how Doctor Who is going to be cancelled either are doing it just to be clickbait, and I think that's probably a big part of it, or they just don't understand the fundamentals of what they're writing about, which is probably an even bigger worry, because if you are going to go out there online and say something, you really should be sure of what you're saying. Anyway, that's it for the news this week. As always, if you want to get in touch, Facebook, Twitter, email, whatever you like, all those details are in the closing credits at the end of the show. Well, all right, and on to our first feature of this episode of Who Wars, and this is really a teaser for what's coming next Wednesday night. Now, I've already talked about this a bit earlier in the episode, so I won't labour the point here, but basically, Lex, Kate, and myself have sat down and discussed the final six episodes of this last series of Doctor Who, Series 8, similar to how we did it in early October, where we discussed the first six episodes of the show. We basically sat down a roundtable format and gave our thoughts, whether they're the same thoughts as we've had before or whether they're updated thoughts in some cases. That's always quite interesting. And then at the end, we wrap it all up with our thoughts on the series overall. Now, this is particularly interesting because Kate doesn't review Doctor Who episodes at all on Who Wars, so her views are always new and fresh. And for Lex and myself, well, we do have some differing ideas from what we might have first said in our original reviews of these episodes. So look, without any further ado, here's a taste of our discussion on Death in Heaven. This is in lieu of Lex reviewing the episode, this Who Wars. She'll be leading the conversation here with myself and Kate chiming in, and this ought to give you a taste for what we've done for next Wednesday night, where we discuss all six of the second half of Series 8. Please enjoy.
So Death in Heaven was directed by Rachel Talalay. How do you say her name again, Rob?
I say Talalay.
Talalay. All right, that sounds good.
I just made that up.
Rachel Talalay. And it's written by Stephen Moffat. The final figures are not released, but we know that the overnight ratings were estimated to be 5.45 million viewers, and the episode received mostly positive reviews. Dan Martin, writing for The Guardian, praised Michelle Gomez's performance, noting that she preens, yes, preens, with a perfect combination of madness and malevolence that is just so master. So he summed up the final as action-packed, uncompromising, and filled with genuine emotion. Gavin Clark, however, of The Register gave it an overwhelmingly negative view, saying the finale couldn't lift itself up from the messy Morris of the rest of the season. It didn't make sense. It was ridiculous and contrived and just not engaging. He was critical of plot holes in the episode and the fact no explanation was given for how the Master returned. He was, however, pleased with Gomez's performance, believing it to be the best part of the episode, calling her fantastic. So I thought those were two really good reviews, but first, was it satisfying for you guys, the end?
No.
Yeah. You want to go into it? Rob, your review of it was a definite no, I think.
Yeah, look, it felt really unresolved for me. Even when you have Clara and the Doctor saying goodbye and we sit there thinking, oh, look, they're both lying to each other so they don't hurt each other's feelings, you know, and all of this, it still didn't feel resolved to me. It's the strangest thing. I don't know whether I've got to watch it another dozen times or something and something will finally click in my head. But I was going to say, it just unresolved is the best way I can describe the ending.
Yeah, maybe after we see some of Series 9, maybe it'll make more sense or something like that. But yeah, I thought it was very anticlimactic, and I was expecting more of a bang, and I just didn't get it.
Yeah, isn't it kind of sad that we have to sort of hope for a continuation of this whole story for the next season? It really, I get the same lack of resolution. Although I think I'm a little bit more comfortable with it. For some reason, that last scene with them both continuing to lie to each other, it's become such a pattern now that I've become accustomed to it, and it's okay for me a little bit more. I mean, it's not okay, but I'm comfortable with it a little.
Mm.
Not happy, but comfortable.
Well, look, all through, I thought, and I said this many times, and I stick my hand up again, I thought Clara was heading for a big fall, you know, with all these lies, with all these issues she was creating for herself, with her addiction to time travel. It had to be going somewhere. I thought, it is impossible that this can't be going somewhere. And then in this final episode,
It didn't really go anywhere. It was Danny who got killed.
Right.
Clara came out of it pretty much okay. And then it ended.
Yeah. I liked how my prediction for how it should have ended better was that she should have killed herself to be with Danny, and then the Nether Sphere would be destroyed. Like, so basically there would be like nothing left. I thought that would have been good.
Yeah, that's dark, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm dark.
Oh, look, it would have been much better than what we got, in my opinion, anyway.
I need to be a writer for the show.
Yeah. Wait, can we pause this for a second?
Yeah, sure.
And maybe you want to keep parts of this, but the whole connection of Missy choosing Clara kind of escaped me. I need a little assistance, guys. I haven't watched, or we rewatched some of the last episodes as well as the other ones, just watching it again ever. So, what was the connection with Missy and Clara? What was that? Well, how was Clara picked?
She selected her. Because she was a control freak? That's what I got from it.
She brought them two together as a weakness?
Because she thought that because Clara was such a control freak that it would drive the doctor nuts. It was like diabolical. Yeah,
it kind of turned out that Missy was doing this all for the doctor, like taking over Earth, kind of ironically spiting him, like, I'm killing your Earth, but I'm giving you all this power at the same time. Let's be friends. She's insane. So was she
perfect companion?
She brought him the perfect companion to rule over Earth?
I don't know, is the quick answer from me.
Yeah, okay, so maybe you can keep this on the recording. What was the link?
I don't know. I'm as in the dark as you are. And so, you know, I think we know Doctor Who and we've watched a lot of episodes. And yet, if it's not apparent to us, how apparent would it be to many people?
True.
Right. Okay. So I can feel better about myself. I don't see that. Every line that Missy gave seemed to be observing Clara, I guess. And there was just not a proper explanation of what was the thing with Missy and Clara?
Don't know.
Okay, well, that is a problem.
It's a huge problem, I agree.
Yeah. I'll be watching the episodes again when I get the chance, but yeah.
But on the plus side, Mary Poppins, right?
Oh, yeah, let's talk about Mary Poppins.
Yes,
yeah,
that was
not?
Amazing. I love that.
Mary Poppins is a Time Lord, so that all works out.
Exactly.
Yeah, when she floated into that graveyard on the umbrella, it looked fantastic.
That was awesome.
Oh God, yeah. It's funny how the critic that I just introduced when we're talking about this episode gave the word preening attached to Missy. She really is like a deranged peacock, you know?
Yeah.
I think, is that the bird that's on the end of Mary Poppins' umbrella, or is it a parrot? I don't know. It's just,
I think it's
so
a parrot.
Yeah, it is a parrot, right?
Yeah.
So that made sense to me.
That's funny.
She's Mary Poppins' parrot, but turned into a Time Lord. I don't know. It's great. I love all the associations.
That was amazing.
All right, so let's move on to the other question. We've already talked about that. I was going to ask, did we like Missy? Or rather, was there anything you didn't like Missy? How about that? What didn't we like about Missy?
Ooh. Not enough screen time.
Okay. Yeah, that is a very important part. Her lines were hardly there. Not enough screen time, not enough lines, nothing actually made sense.
But what lines she had were fantastic. When she says to Osgood, I'm going to kill you in a minute, or 20 seconds, or whatever it was.
I'm a horrible person, but that scene was, like, hilarious.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
Yeah, deranged. Absolutely brilliantly deranged. Yeah.
And
the substance, though, just wasn't there.
Mm. And this is why I want to see more of the Michelle Gomez mistress, because I want to see the character build up a bit. I don't want the master to appear again in another year's time and it's someone else playing him, or, you know, her, if it's another female actress. I want this master to go on. I liked that they allowed this master to just kill people just so in such a deranged way.
Yeah. She was terrifying.
Like Osgood and throwing... Well, she didn't throw Kate Stewart out of the plane, but caused her to fall out of the plane. Would we have liked it if Kate had maybe stayed dead?
I don't ever want to see a character named Kate dead.
Oh! I didn't even think about that.
I'm with you on that. My sister's name is Kate. Not ever. But how about that Oswald? Or is it Oswald?
Osgood?
Osgood!
It's Oswin Osgood, I think.
That's it. Oswin Osgood. She was brilliant, and they killed her.
I wasn't the biggest fan of her, actually. I felt like it was too meta. She's too meta of a character. Like, she's supposed to be every fangirl.
Oh, she absolutely is.
Yeah. So, still. I mean, she was fine for the one episode before, but I thought that was a good way for her to end.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did see a comment on Twitter. Someone said, okay, that's it, Moffat. You've now killed a fan.
Yeah. That's exactly what he did.
That's true.
Which would probably appeal to his sense of humor, actually.
Very, very funny.
With all the grief he gets from some of them.
Yeah, maybe it was a little retribution on his part.
But who knows? I mean, she's a smart cookie. She might have a magic way to appear again. I don't know.
Yeah. I know I had been reading some comments and stuff, but like a lot of people wanted her to be the next companion, but...
Well, it was foreshadowed in that episode, you know, when the doctor said all of time and space, and she was started to hyperventilate and had to have her Ventolin.
Yeah, I don't think she would be a good companion personally, but...
Maybe for an episode.
Not long term, definitely not.
Not long term. So back to the Kates, though. Kate's dad, not your dad, Kate, the other Kate, the Brigadier... Were we comfortable with the Brigadier becoming a Cyberman? Keeping in mind all the past companions also who are dead at that point on Earth would have been a Cyberman as well.
I felt really weird about it, you know, because he's a classic character I grew up with, and the thought of him being a Cyberman was really, really weird to me. I felt really oddly about it, actually.
Weird. Me being... somewhat of a newer fan, I really didn't even know who he was other than the references that Kate had made to him, so it didn't really affect me.
I'm not that familiar with him either, but I do a lot of Doctor Who trivia, and he comes up often enough in that, so he is an important person, a character to in my mind. I didn't feel comfortable with it because of that. It seemed unnecessary, it kind of picking... I don't know, at our heartstrings in some way. He's just too important a character to do that, too.
But didn't he end up saving them?
Did he?
No?
Because if
he saved Kate.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's what it was.
He saved Kate, right. But then, so did he kill Missy afterwards, too? Because then Missy's never going to come back, and we need her to come back, right?
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. He did shoot her, and she dissolved. But as I said straight after the episode, when she dissolved, it was blue. And in the episode, everyone dissolving had been red. And when she had teleported in the episode, it was also blue. So I wonder if she teleported at the moment he shot her.
It was distinctly blue. Mm. I think that's a huge hint. So all that goes to waste. The Brigadier coming back, shooting Missy, all of it a waste. It's unnecessary and distressing. And, you know, I've already said that.
Yeah. And like your question said, you know, all the other companions who are dead at this point, like Sarah Jane Smith... She's a Cyberman. She's out there somewhere as a Cyberman, you know? Who else could be dead at this point? Maybe some of the 60s companions, you know, if someone's got favorites there. In your mind, you're imagining all these people have risen out of their graves as Cybermen.
Yeah. It had to be him.
Well, what about Osgood? Did she turn into one?
She must have. No. But her body was completely obliterated.
Yeah. Well, Rob kind of got into that in his review a little bit.
Well, that, and yes, and I'll jump in and say, yeah, because in that, in the caretaker, the policeman was shot and only his hand hit the ground. So he was like, you know, blown away, literally. Right. And yet he appeared in heaven as a full body and met up with Seb, who introduced him to the Nethersphere and all of that. So it's like they get some sort of artificial body in the Nethersphere.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, they do get a new body in the Nethersphere. They do have a line addressing that.
Yeah, and that's why, I was going to say, that's why Danny Pink in the Nethersphere looked normal, but when we went back to Earth, he was starting to decompose, like there were dark rings under his eyes and, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah. Right. That and was like his actual body. Right?
What you said in the last episode of the podcast, though, that what are they doing with these really old bodies that are completely dissolved?
Mm, yeah. I don't know.
So,
Yeah, because, I mean, in the past, Cybermen have needed, like, a physical body to fill out the suit. You know, like, they cybernetically enhance a human body, but they're still a body. If it's just dust, are these is this Cyberpollen really reanimating dust into a skeleton or something more than a skeleton? Or
I think dodgy science.
Dodgy science.
Dodgy science and territory marking. We've talked about territory marking before on...
Yeah.
On, it's gone wrong. Massive Cybermen. He had that whole interview that you read. He had that whole interview talking about Cybermen in the history. Like, you would think that he'd pay more respect to the history of Cybermen, and he's changing everything. Yeah.
Well, look, I would still say the biggest change to Cybermen were when they came back in this new series back in 2005-06 and so. They were Cybermen from another dimension. They were the Cybus Industries Cybermen. I felt that was really a bridge too far because they weren't the Cybermen. They weren't my Cybermen. So at least these guys are the Cybermen because they're not the Cybus Industries alternate universe Cybermen. But if that makes any sense, if there's anyone still listening to us as I go through this meandering anecdote, yeah, but it still is a stretch. It still is territory marking. It's the invention of this cyber pollen. I mean...
That was weird.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about it.
Awful. I couldn't believe it. I literally did not believe it for a second. want to. No.
Yeah, I just still don't know how it works.
Yeah, I think we'll have to just come to terms with that on our own somehow over time. Everything becomes okay over time.
Yeah.
Last question. Was the Clara and Doctor story resolved at the end? Was that a real ending, or was it completely unresolved? Do you think she is coming back next season? Also, this is the big one, is she pregnant?
No, yes, yes.
No, the Clara and Doctor story was not resolved. Yes, she's coming back season, and was that a yes or a no on your third?
Yes.
Yes, she is pregnant. You think, Kate?
Yeah, I definitely feel like it was unresolved. As far as her being pregnant, I could see it going either way. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did have the whole thing with Orson Welles. Orson Pink. I was talking about that when I watched that episode. I was like, you don't hear the name Orson very much, except Orson Welles. Anyway, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see next season if she is indeed pregnant. And I was curious, Rob, you said about the post-it notes. Was there some... Did I miss something? Like, that she said... Did I?
Can you clarify that again?
Yeah.
There was... Oh, look, this is off the top of my head. But there was a post-it note, I'm sure, that had 3 months written on it.
Okay, so it was that one that I saw, yeah.
There was another one that said, tell him... Which is a bit ambiguous, I admit. Tell him could just be... She should say, I love you to him, maybe. That's what she should tell him.
Tell him the truth.
You know, but the 3 months, that's a very specific time frame. You know, so has it been 3 months? Is she 3 months? Well, I don't know. She's little.
Yeah.
I'm no expert on that. I have no children.
Yeah, it's debatable. 3 months doesn't... It could be something else. But it would certainly explain the whole Orson story. Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, to go back to, was it unresolved? I mean, yes, we began this review with me saying that. I think it was. I think it's unresolved. I think she's pregnant. And I don't think she'll come back as a companion, but I think maybe a cameo of some kind.
Well... I think it's a great lead-in to the next season. It's going to be one of the things that I'm really excited about to be resolved.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I have some questions that include what's coming up in the next series, so...
What about the Christmas episode?
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, too. I guess if they're all your questions, Lex, we just need to do a rating on this one.
A rating on this one. Okay. Rob, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll stick around 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10?
Mm-hmm.
Kate?
I'm going to give this one
6.5.
Yeah.
Yeah, what did I give this one? I gave this one a 6.
Mm.
Yeah. Pretty low.
It is.
For a finale, it was kind of a letdown.
Like, let's give that, what Danny did at the end, some credit about giving
Yes, absolutely.
That's gotta get some props there.
That, was it the last, or no, I forget which episode it was where he, okay, wait, I think it was The Forest in the Night, where he was explaining to Clara why he doesn't want to be a time traveler. And then I kind of liked him a little more after that, like, because you could kind of understand more where he was coming from. And then this episode, like, yeah, that was very heroic, and I loved that part of it.
Yeah, I that helped some resolution, I thought. That whole soldier arc that was going on, soldiers were rectified.
So I was a little confused. You know how he made such a big deal about digging 23 wells earlier in the season? Was that just because he felt guilty because he had killed that kid?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. And did he actually build those or dig those wells, or was he just lying about that, like just to make himself feel better?
Oh, I'm sure he did. My take, and this isn't proven by anything except my own imagination. My take is he's probably an army engineer of some kind.
Oh.
Maybe out there digging lots of wells, and then that firefight we see is just something that they fell into. You know, sometimes engineers have to fight like that as well. So, you know, that's the way I sort of explained it in my head.
So Danny actually has more than one heroic moment, you know, when he commands the cyber army, and then when he lets the kid go back. Go, Danny!
Still doesn't explain the somersault in The Caretaker.
Yeah, so are you gonna... You said you were gonna, like, take a star off or something, right?
That's right. I still don't understand how he did that somersault.
Weird. That was just silly. They were just, like, adding this silly
showing off
aspect.
Their special... their stunts. That's the word.
Yeah.
Showing off stunts.
Yes, agreed.
One last thing I'll toss up before we get on to just my wrap-up. What did we think of the fact the Cybermen can now fly? They're sort of like Iron Man now.
Yeah, it was very much like that scene in the last Iron Man movie.
Mm.
So, scary. I don't know.
They're terrifying.
Yeah, and I'm not a big fan of the Cybermen, actually, just in general.
Yeah, they are usually kind of boring. But yeah. Anything that flies is kind of scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I covered this in a recent episode. They're funny for me because I like them very, very much. But it's kind of I like them in theory more so than when they come on screen.
Oh, gotcha.
Like, I love the whole background to them and how the guys on Mondas, the planet's dying, and they start replacing themselves cybernetically and they go too far. And it was a whole... In the 60s, it was a forewarning of what might happen to the human race, you know, because the guy who invented them was looking around and saying, look at how we're starting to do all this stuff with science and with our bodies, and what would happen if we took it too far.
I'm thinking of another Star Trek reference, but I'm restraining myself from saying it.
Okay. And, you know, and all that background I love about the Cybermen, and I love the way they look, but when they're on screen, I don't think they get written very well in a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
hard. They just
hard.
Don't get them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I like that, what you were saying about them and stuff, but it seems like that just doesn't translate onto screen.
Oh, the original 60s kind of idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, not really, not anymore. Okay, and we'll cut it off there before we get into our wrap-up of Series 8 and what Kate, Lex, and myself thought of the series overall. If you want to hear that, you'll have to tune in next Wednesday night to hear it. So, if you liked that kind of roundtable discussion, please tune in then, and you'll hear us discuss the final 6 episodes in that series. I hope you enjoy this kind of thing. We certainly enjoy doing it. I think we'd have conversations like this every week if we could. It's always just time zones that get in the way. So, yeah, look, please tune in next Wednesday night. Tell your friends. It's about an hour and 20, the episode, I think. It's well worth your time if you're a Doctor Who fan. But without any further ado, let's get into some Star Wars. All right then, this week's episode of Star Wars Rebels was called Out of Darkness, and here to discuss it with me, as always, is my wife Leo. Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm not too bad at all. How's life down the hall?
Pretty good.
Good to hear. Shall we get into this episode?
Let's go.
I guess the first thing to say is this was a very Sabine and Hera heavy episode. I don't think we've had one of those yet.
No,
And you say that, but we got to see a little bits of the rest of the crew too, so it wasn't completely Sabine and Hera.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? I mean, out of the whole crew, I think we saw the least of Kanan, and in fact, across a lot of these episodes, Kanan seems to be very underplayed at the moment.
Yeah, that's a bit interesting. I guess it's more Ezra's the main protagonist, maybe, and Kanan's like the mentor figure, but like we haven't seen that yet, so I mean, I see where it's going to go, but it hasn't really happened yet.
Yeah, certainly Ezra gets the lion's share, like it's either an Ezra episode or an Ezra and Zeb episode, or, you know, Ezra's involved somehow, and even in this episode, although it was a very Sabine and Hera sort of episode, he did get some good scenes, like fighting with Chopper on board the Ghost, or, you know, jumping into the fight at the end of the episode and having to be hauled out by Sabine. He's always in the thick of things, but the others kind of rotate around him, I guess.
Yeah, that's a astute way of looking at it.
Well, thank you. Pacing-wise, I found this to be really good. It felt longer than an average episode. It was still the typical 21 minutes or whatever it is, but pacing-wise, I think it stretched out a nice story from the fight at the start with the TIE fighters through to what happened down on the planet through to the rescue. I felt like it told a story in a better way than some of the more recent episodes.
Maybe it just covered more ground. Well, maybe. I felt like the last episode was getting the pacing right, but it wasn't quite there. But this one definitely is. Yeah, I agree. The pacing is getting better.
Now, I know you like the Sabine character, and in this one, we had Sabine. It hasn't come up before that she has trust issues. Well, not that I've noticed anyway, but in this episode, she wanted to know everything. She wanted to know who all the secret contacts were. She wanted to know what was going on. Was that sort of surprising to you, how that sort of just came out of nowhere?
Not really, because of the fact that she's a Mando. I would expect them to be the kind of people that like to know the battlefield, know what they're up against at all times, to be the most efficient fighters that they are. But what surprised me was her background in the Imperial Academy, which, you know, a few episodes back when she was pretending to be from the Academy, well, maybe she had something real to draw from for that role. And that kind of took me by more surprise than her trust issues. I was glad that she... Okay, trust issue characters can be a bit hit and miss. Sometimes they can go over the top, and you're like, oh my gosh, come on. Let's just have some faith once in a while, as Hera says. But I think it was well-founded, and it added a lot to her, and she was asking all the important questions. She was asking all the things I was asking, like, in my own head when I'm watching things. You know, a lot of the questions that came up in previous podcasts.
I must admit, I got a bit confused at first when she started talking about being at the Academy. I thought she meant the Academy that we saw in the previous episode where Ezra was. And then we learned that there is an Academy on Mandalore.
That was a bit surprising. I'm trying to figure out the strategic advantage of building an Imperial Academy on Mandalore. I guess at this point, Mandalore has lost its significance once the Empire has come along, hasn't it?
Oh, well, it's just so... It's funny, they've tried to decomplicate everything by getting rid of the EU, but at least in the EU we sort of knew how Mandalore was set up and who was in charge and what happened there, and now it's all out the window, and, you know, particularly the Karen Travis books, which I loved, are out the window and the way she treated Mandalore, so now, hey, Mandalore's got its own Imperial Academy, apparently.
I guess it's not too surprising, it just kind of... It's when people name drop, like, I'm from Mandalore, you know, you expect a certain thing, and that's maybe not the thing to expect now. And I'm a little confused there, but okay, whatever, I can go with it. She used to be rah-rah pro-Empire, and now she's, I'm a Mando, and okay, I can go with that.
Yeah, but it does come across, you know, the question she was asking, yes, I can see how you can see they were Mandalorian, but even... when they got rescued, who was the first person to jump on the guns in the ship and keep blowing away the creatures? It was her. And I'm thinking, oh, that was very Mando of her.
Oh, yeah. She definitely sticks to the MO of what you would expect from a Mando.
Now, I'd like to see more Sabine episodes, actually.
Yeah, I'd like to
know more about why she has those trust issues.
Yeah, well, we don't know much about her background at all. I mean, that reveal that she had been at the academy training to go into the Empire, that's one of the biggest reveals we've had about her so far. Okay, what about the other characters in the episode? As you say, we did get a bit of a look at them. We'll start with Kanan, because I'm thinking of that moment where he was meditating and said that Sabine and Hera are in trouble. They said, how do you know? He said, oh, because I heard you talking outside the door.
That made me laugh. I love the moments when Jedi don't do Jedi things, but I think that's kind of become a popular theme now. But with me, I just like when they're real people, because they are real people. They don't use the Force for everything. They don't take it for granted.
Yeah, and Freddie Prinze Jr. in interviews says that he doesn't even consider Kanan to be a Jedi Knight yet, in terms of the training he's had before Order 66 happened. So, you know, to see him, you know, he's got a lightsaber and he meditates and he can use the Force and so on, but he's not really a full Jedi Knight, let alone a Master.
It's probably the period of Luke Skywalker's training that we didn't really get to see between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. It's a lot like that, I imagine.
Yeah, he's competent, but he's certainly not what a full Jedi Knight would be, which, yeah, you're right, is what we saw of the Jedi in the original trilogy. You know, when you see Ben and Vader fighting, it's a broken down old man versus a half machine man. When Luke is fighting him, you know, he's taking these wild swings at Vader, like, you know, he's chopping wood, which I guess at the time we all thought was really cool. But when you actually saw the Jedi fight in the prequels, it did set up this difference that in the old Republic, the Jedi could really fight in a very good, very stylish way compared to, you know, an untrained sort of boy like Luke Skywalker was.
Yeah, and there's lots of different lightsaber techniques, and we haven't even seen all of those, and a lot of them are EU stuff. I wonder if we'll see some of that in the future. Just totally different techniques of how to swing, how to move.
Yeah, I mean, that got referenced to some degree when they were fighting the Inquisitor an episode or two back. The Inquisitor said he was relying, I think, you rely too much on Form 3, I think was the phrase or something. So they sort of got name-checked.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
It was the throwaway line in the fight, it's easy to miss. I only noticed it because I pulled it out for a segment in an earlier episode.
I'm just trying to think in my head of all the various Star Wars games I've played, and they always have really cool names for the different Jedi techniques that you learn as you... You know, as if you're playing like a Jedi character in the Jedi Knight series or Knights of the Old Republic or, you know.
Yeah, no, I get you. Okay, so looking at the episode overall, I felt it was well paced. I liked that it was a Hera and Sabine episode, which is a rare sort of thing. I was pretty happy with this. You know, it's a 7 or 8 out of 10 for me. What about you?
Oh, it's definitely up there, 8 or 9 maybe. I really enjoy that Sabine is not just a kid, like she can think on her feet and she can adapt to a situation. I really like the way she used the explosive stuff. Wasn't too too into the multicolored explosions. I think that's just the Disney thing.
Yeah, we had more of those this week. Like we had the Jedi crystals blow up with a green effect last week, and I thought, oh, okay, that's fair enough. It's a very special crystal, but yeah, that was these multicolored explosions were very.
I think they're just looking for places where they can do multicolored effects that just for the rule of cool, I guess. It's not a big deal, but it just seems a bit unrealistic.
And just on Sabine too, there was that line to Ezra where she saved him and then she said to him, you know, don't read too much into it. Like, if we're thinking that Sabine and Ezra might have a relationship at some stage, at this point it's definitely not on. I don't think she's too interested in him at all.
What's the age difference between them anyway? Like, isn't she more of a teenager and he's kind of like a preteen?
The quick answer is I don't know, and again, I do need to buy that visual dictionary, I think, to get up on the ages of them. I think they're similar in age. I don't think it would be too weird for them to have a romance.
Well, she always calls him kid, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah, I think that's... It could partly be she's maybe a few years older than him. I mean, look at Padme and Anakin. She was a lot older than him.
Oh, I wasn't thinking of it in terms of their age gap. It's just teenagers tend to... go older than younger, you know, because they're kind of like wanting to be adults.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, and before we go, there was, in each episode, I sort of see things that remind me of the original trilogy, and in this one, it was when Ezra was repairing the Phantom, the little ship that pops out of the Ghost, and Chopper turned on some controls prematurely and filled where he was working with steam and light. It reminded me very much of when Han was working on the Millennium Falcon in Empire Strikes Back, and I think Chewie turned something on that caused a similar effect.
Oh, yeah. Something that reminded me of original trilogy, I think when the Ghost arrives to save the day, the music kind of plays up there, and it didn't remind me of a particular scene, but it felt very Star Wars. Like, this episode really felt, okay, Star Wars, I'm into this now. I think we might even be having a story arc set up with this Fulcrum character, maybe. You know, and the music's there, the characters are there, the tone is right, you know. That moment just for me kind of brought it home, you know.
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, it did raise some questions for me if they have this informant who's delivered them some materials and he's left them sitting just outside where these wild creatures are that have apparently scared everyone away since the Clone Wars. Why would he not say, hey, and watch out for the local wildlife while you're there? He sort of gave no warning at all. So I don't know whether that's an oversight or whether this guy might be leading them into traps from time to time.
Maybe. And it sounds like it's a bigger player than their previous boss, Viago or whatever.
Yeah, so there's certainly some storylines opening up. Pacing was good. I found this very solid. Sounds like this could be one of your favourite episodes of the series so far, with the score you gave it.
Yeah, I like the last episode. Was getting there. The space battle especially really got me excited. But this one just felt like, even when they're talking about like the diagnostic and fixing the Phantom and stuff, I just thought, oh, they're in space. They're talking about space things. They're doing spacey things. This is cool. This is the sort of stuff I like.
Yeah. I thought you would be as I looked over at you watching it. So that's good.
Yeah.
All right.
And I look forward to more of Sabine, obviously. I mean, she's probably going to be my favorite character.
Yeah, either her or Zeb, I guess, for you.
Yeah, Zeb's kind of faded into the background a bit more now. But we'll see what he gets up to.
Okay. Well, we'll see what they get up to next week.
Yes, we will.
Will you join me then?
I will.
Lovely. See you then.
See you then.
Greetings, Earthlings and non-Earthlings. How's it going? I'm doing pretty good here. I'm still on a bit of a Star Wars high from getting our title announcement last week. And this review I am very excited to do because I enjoyed it very much. If you heard my last secondhand Star Wars segment, I mentioned that I had gotten The Shadows of the Empire audiobook, so that's what I'll be reviewing this time. And in case you've never heard of it, Shadows of the Empire is a multimedia project from the mid-90s that included the novel, a comic series, a video game, and even a soundtrack. The novel was written by Steve Perry, and it's read, once again, by Anthony Heald, who I enjoy very much. And basically, this story is episode 5.5 because it takes place between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. So after The Empire Strikes Back, we've got the gang, Luke, Leia, Chewie, the droids, and Lando, trying to rescue Han, who's currently frozen in carbonite, from Boba Fett, who's on his way to deliver Han to Jabba the Hutt. And meanwhile, we have the main villain, Prince Chizor, who is second only to Vader and the Emperor. And he's trying to eliminate Luke and Darth Vader. And he was seeking revenge on Darth Vader because years earlier, Darth Vader had inadvertently killed a good chunk of his family. I thought that Chizor was quite an intriguing character, not only because of his unique green-skinned look, but he's got wealth, power, charisma, and pheromones that can make most women, even Leia briefly, fall for him. And then there's also the rugged freelance cargo delivery guy, Dash Rendar. He's funny, brash, charming. Sound familiar? Yeah, I know he's basically a ripoff of Han Solo, but I rather liked him. In fact, I think we need to have a Dash Rendar spinoff film. And Chris Pratt can play him. I mean, Chris Pratt, he did a pretty good Star-Lord in Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Hey, wait. Maybe Marvel and Lucasfilm can do a crossover where Star-Lord enters a portal into the Star Wars galaxy and he actually is Dash Rendar. That would be pretty awesome. But back to the review. We see some really cool stuff in this book, like Luke building his lightsaber on Tatooine, Luke and Leia communicating via the Force, a cameo by Obi-Wan, and a space casino. And then it also has some really funny moments too, like when Leia sends Dash Rendar to basically babysit Luke on Tatooine, and then Luke just sends him right back to watch over Leia. And then at one point, Luke's trying to figure out this password of Leia's, and he wrongly guesses that it is Luke Skywalker, so that was pretty hilarious. And then the whole scene where Chizor is seducing Leia, that was pretty funny too. I like this because it feels like Star Wars, and it fits right into the original trilogy seamlessly. In fact, I know that this isn't officially canon, but in my heart, it's always going to be, and I'm proclaiming this Kate-level canon. So any other legends that I read that I enjoy this much are also going to get that designation. The audio aspects of this were top-notch, just like the other Star Wars one that I've read so far. The music, sound effects, character voices, they're all very highly entertaining. And Anthony Heald, he just does a great job. I could listen to this over and over again, and I probably will. And this one, I believe, is abridged, similar to the last one that I did, but I think I might even go out and buy the full unabridged version of the novel and read that. That's how much I like this. The only negative things that I have to say about this are that I wish I would have read this sooner, and I wish that Steve Perry had more novels. As far as I could tell, this was the only Star Wars novel that he did, so that's kind of a bummer. So overall, I know I'm kind of late to the party, but this book really does have it all. Humor, adventure, characters we love, and new as well as familiar locations. So yeah, this was so good. I think I have to give this book my first 10 out of 10 lightsaber rating. So it made me want to go back and dig out my Nintendo 64 and find that Shadows of the Empire game so I can actually finish it. I don't think I finished it back in the 90s. And then also, remember that pod racing game? That was pretty awesome too. I've got some gaming to do. Until next time, allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
Alright, moving on to Doctor Who comics. This is a comic I wanted to review last episode. Indeed, I had the issue in front of me, I just didn't have the time to do it. I'm in a similar situation actually this week where I have the next 12th Doctor comic which comes out in the week ahead. I have it here, I could review it, but I just don't have the time. So let's review the 10th Doctor number 4 in this episode, and we'll look at 12th Doctor number 2 in the next episode, and hopefully we'll start to catch up on these Doctor Who comics as they fire out thick and fast from the folks at Titan. This is, as I said, 10th Doctor number 4. The story itself, though, is called The Arts in Space Part 1. The writer is Nick Abadsis, who has been on the first three issues so far. The artist is Eleanor Casagrande, who has also been on the first three issues so far, so not much has changed there. And look, let's rip into it. I guess the first and most notable thing to say about this issue is about the artwork, and I think it's really, really interesting. The issue starts with what we presume is Gabby Gonzalez writing to a friend, perhaps writing in a diary. This friend is called Cindy, and she's describing her adventures with the Doctor. And it's done in a, you know, we're sort of believing here that this is her handwriting. It's not done in sort of a comic font. It's in handwriting. I think it's actually Eleanor Casagrande's handwriting from the looks of things. And I know that because I own some of her comic art, and just the way she signed her name there is very similar to the handwriting here. And the drawings themselves are different to the comic art, so they certainly stand out when juxtaposed against the comic art. They look very Disney-like. and they're coloured in pastel-y colours. It's kind of like a Disney-like diary entry that she's sketching here and talking to her friend Cindy. And I've got to say two things here. One is that I like this. I think it's very imaginative. I think it's very cool to look at. I like the way we get inside Gabby's head because she's obviously writing these notes to her friend. I think the this Disney-fied pastel-y artwork is quite cool to look at. But the way she's describing the adventures to the friend, the way she's describing what the Doctor's like, this could have almost been issue one of the series to me. Obviously, we had the first three issues telling the story of Gabby in New York City and how she met the Doctor and all of that sort of stuff. Ultimately, though, you could have almost started the series with this issue, and we would just accept that, oh, Gabby is someone who's now adventuring with the Doctor, and then she tells the backstory through these diary entries. So it's good in the sense that the art is great, getting in her head is great, but it's kind of bad in the sense that you almost feel like you're going backwards here. Like, we know Gabby Gonzalez, and we certainly know the Doctor, because we're Doctor Who fans. We're now four issues into the comic, and we're having this sort of backstory being told, like, oh, I'm adventuring with the Doctor, and he's like this and that, and I'm in the TARDIS, and it looks like this. And it's like, really? Are we really sort of rebooting the series almost, you know, four issues in? It's kind of odd in that sense. And honestly, I think I would have liked issue one to have started here and just accepted that Gabby was on board and she comes from New York City and just gone from here. Because truth be told, when I look back at those first three issues, the story ultimately wasn't that satisfying. And what's being told here is a much more interesting tale of the Doctor and Gabby landing on this planet. He's taking her to an art gallery. When they get there, the artwork he wants to show her is missing. The artist behind the artwork lives up on a moon that's floating above this planet. There's a space elevator that takes him up there. It's very sci fantasy. It's very cool. It's very interesting. And when they get up there to this estate on this moon after taking the space elevator, there's all these creepy statues in the grounds of the house. They start attacking the Doctor and Gabby. It's all very interesting. And then, of course, when they get inside and they're looking for the artist, this artist called Jay, who we learn is a very interesting artist, often changing his or her sex from time to time in order to create different artworks, like just this fascinating backstory we get told about this artist. We then come across these apprentices who are inside the house. They can't find Jay, but they do find all these art apprentices who are very odd, very evil, can sort of shapeshift. You know, they start attacking the Doctor and Gabby. And they can turn their hands into scissors and they can sprout second heads, and it gets very weird, very sci-fi, and it's really cool. And it ends on a cliffhanger with the Doctor diving into a room and starting to fall because the room is not quite what it seems. I'm trying not to spoil too much. If you've read it though, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And yeah, like all the Titan comics thus far, the Doctor's voice is very authentic. You can absolutely read this in David Tennant's own voice. Of course, we can't read it in Gabby's voice because we don't really know what Gabby might sound like, but that's okay. The Doctor's voice is authentic. The story is very sci-fi, very Doctor Who, very Tennant era. That's cool. So, you know, Abadsis and Casagrande have just nailed it here between the writing and the artwork. It's a really enjoyable issue. I'm really interested to see where it goes. I'm interested to see if they can find this artist, Jay. I'm wondering why these art apprentices are just attacking the Doctor and Gabby and are so evil. And yeah, it's a good, solid issue for those of you who are reading the 10th Doctor series. And as I was saying, you could almost start on this issue. I think you could start on this issue, actually. You haven't really missed a lot in those initial three issues. You can start here, and as long as you can accept that the Doctor now adventures with this person called Gabby, who is the companion who falls after Donna Noble, then go for it. You're cool. You can start right here. So, thumbs up for this issue. I like it a lot. I'm interested to see where it goes. And that's all you can really ask of any monthly comic, isn't it?
This is M.A. Tambora reminding you that for free, full episodes of Doctor Who Dark Journey, news, cast info, and much more, visit us online at amaudiomedia.com.
Cool beans!
Okie dokie, that brings us to the end of the 15th Who Wars. My thanks as always to Leo, Lex and Kate for contributing to the show, being part of the team. If you want to be part of the team, there are many ways you can do it. You can be submitting material on a regular basis or a semi-regular basis. If you've got something about Star Wars or Doctor Who that you'd like to get off your chest regularly or semi-regularly, please get in touch and let me know about it. We don't have to do these things live. You can record them in your own time, in your own way, and then submit them to me and we'll run them as part of the show. This is all about grassroots podcasting. We're not a team that just wants to be insular. We want to throw it open to everyone out there, anyone who wants to have a voice out there in podcasting. This is the show for you. This is your opportunity to do it. Even if you have a really, really good one-off kind of piece that you want to do, maybe some sort of essay that you'd written and you'd like to read it out as a spoken word piece, I'll look at those. You know, I'm really open to Star Wars and Doctor Who fans expressing their fandom through Who Wars. So think about that. Think about if that's something you might like to do. Even if you already submit to other podcasts out there, I'm not precious about that kind of thing at all. If you've got something you want to say here, please let me know about it. All the ways to reach me are in the credits I'm about to hit play on. And to go back to what I was saying in the intro to the show, if you do have an iTunes account, I would love a rating and review for the show. It does help us get seen by other fans like yourselves. And that's just a good thing for everyone, don't you think? Anyway, until Wednesday night, when we look at the second half of Series 8 of Doctor Who with Kate and Lex, I remain Rob Irwin. Be good to each other. Have a great rest of the weekend.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.